She wasn't the woman behind the man. She was in charge. And she raised a family while saving a franchise. A South Bend native, she met her husband early in her freshman year at Indiana University. They're still together and will be celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary in June. They've had two or three lifetimes of experiences in basketball, from winning a national championship in college, playing in the NBA, coaching in the NBA, and coaching three championship teams in the ABA. She wasn't just along for the ride, though. She had input and influence, particularly when she ran the Pacers front office for their first 4 years in the NBA, when they were barely making ends meet. She, in fact, was the driving force behind the telethon that saved the franchise in 1977. And oh yeah, while this was going on, she was in charge of raising five kids. She's still a fixture at Pacer games today, sitting front and center. So, in celebration of Mother's Day, let's hear her unique story. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Nancy Leonard.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
All right, today's One-on-One episode comes to you from the residence of Bob and Nancy Leonard in Carmel. We're doing a special Mother's Day episode because Nancy Leonard not only has been a vital figure in the Pacers' history, but also someone who raised five children along with Slick during this time. So I think it's an appropriate story for Mother's Day. And Nancy, let's talk about your background first. You're from South Bend.
I am from South Bend.
Your father owned a construction company.
That's right. It was basically more of a roofing company.
Roofing company. Okay. Would you describe your background as kind of basically middle class, or was it upper middle class, or can you even classify it?
I guess I really wouldn't classify it, but if according to what I think everyone's views are today, and this today, probably middle class. In my eyes, it was upper middle class. In those times, you know, you didn't have 16 cars and 45 closets full of clothes, and but we had everything that we needed, had a nice home, nice schools we attended, lots of kids in the neighborhood. I thought I was really living swell.
And you went, of course, to IU, to Indiana. And I guess that at that time, probably not that many girls from your high school went to college. Would that be true? Or was it
you know,
very
that's
common?
You hit it right there, because I tried to think that there were 10 of us that kind of ran around together. Now, when I say ran around, none of us had cars. There was only one car to a family. So you had fathers driving you to someone's house or downtown to the movies or whatever. I can only think of two of us out of the 10 that actually went to college. And I, to this day, I really don't know how my dad did it, because I never even thought about college till it was like my senior year. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I really like school. And I went home and I said, hey, Dad, I want to go to college.
Why did you go? I mean, what did you want to do? To be a teacher?
Yes, I did. There's a lot of teachers in my family. My mom was a teacher. Her sister, my aunt, was a teacher. Our daughter's a teacher, 30 years in South Bend now. And I did want to teach. At that time, I started out with physical ed and health and safety things. I was real concerned and wanted all kids to be active, because I had come to the conclusion that physical activity made happier kids, and they responded to each other better. And I just thought that was something I wanted to carry on. Ended up starting out in the health field, teaching health with boys, believe it or not, and then picked up accounting down at IU. So I had a combination of the two, and it's worked out pretty good.
Yes.
I've used everything I've learned down there.
Oh, I bet. I bet you have, with all the boys you've raised. Tell me then how you met Bob Leonard.
I've been asked this a million times,
yeah,
but it's kind of a funny story. I had met a friend of his who actually was on that basketball team that Bob was on, and I don't remember how I met Charlie. We had
Charlie
dated
Crack, right?
Charlie Croc. We had met somewhere, and we started dating, and we'd gone to a couple dances, and we were in the same class. We took a lot of anatomy, physiology, and all that, but then we sat in the back row. And Bob was sitting back there beside Charlie, and I was back there too. I didn't know Bob. And one day he sent a message to somebody that he'd like to ask me for a date. And I sent the message back, well, I really couldn't do that because I was dating a friend of his. And I said that was not appropriate. Well, so this went back and forth. And one Sunday afternoon in the dorm, I always classify myself as a nerd because I did have a good time. But I studied a lot. And on Sundays, I never went out or did anything. I started at noon, and I would study till I went to bed at night. But partly because I had a 5:30 anatomy class, and that thing was
5:30 a.m. class?
No, excuse me. I had a five-hour anatomy class that was 5 days a week, 7:30 in the morning, and I had to be ready for it. And at some time, I know why I said five, around 5 o'clock in the evening, I get this knock on my door, and it was a couple of the girls in the dorm, and they said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm studying. What do you want? And they said, well, you got to help us out. I said, well, with what? What do you need? And they said, no. We set this blind date up with this fella to go with this girl, and we can't find her, and everybody's ready to go get something to eat, and they're going to go out a place where they had a little jukebox. And I said, well, I can't go. They said, please, you got to it. This is a horrible situation, and we're really embarrassed, and we'll never ask you for anything else again. I thought, oh, brother. So I got dressed and went out, walked out in the lobby, and it was him. It was Bob. This whole thing was set up. And I, you know, I by this time, thinking, oh, my God, I tell Charlie. So anyway, we went out, and it was very casual. I had a nice time, and I thought, well, you know, this guy is really nice. Wasn't anything like I thought, but that was my introduction to him.
Now, had Bob set that up, or had some of the girls in your sorority done that trick?
I'm not sure how that came about. You know, I don't even know if he would remember, but he obviously was involved with it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, I can't answer that. I don't know.
And do I remember correctly that he had tried to get your attention in class by sticking his foot up in the aisle as you walked by to your seat? Made you step over his foot?
Well, you know, I did think he was kind of jerky. So, but I never put two and two together. I mean, you know, you just didn't.
Okay, so you start dating. But you did not know that he was a member of the basketball team, correct?
No, it gets worse. The story gets worse. So anyway, after we went out, that was on a Sunday, he said, there's a basketball game tomorrow night at the Fieldhouse. Monday night, you play games on Mondays and Saturdays. And he said, do you want to go? Well, I was going to go anyway, but I said, well, yeah, I guess so. That'd be fun. And he said, okay, here's what I want you to do. I need to have you, you need to meet me at the Fieldhouse. I'm to meet him at the Fieldhouse. You know, I'm coming out of high school and dates, and you pick girls up and blah, blah, blah. And he's telling me I got to meet him over there. And he tells me where I'm to go in the field house, and he'll meet me. He'll be at this spot outside this door at the end of the field house inside. Well, I proceeded to tell everyone in the dorm, this guy was a jerkier guy than I thought he was. He's not even going to take me to the ball game. I have to meet him over there. So this is, you know, I've gone through the whole day. So anyway, Kathy and I, my roommate, she was, my roommate Kathy Barnes had been a friend of mine from kindergarten on. We'd gone all the way through elementary, high school, and she was now my roommate at IU. And she's going to the game with me. So we walk over to the field house, the old field house, not right, the new one that we have now. And you walk up a ramp. You had to get there early because there were no reserve tickets. And the first ones that got in for the games got in. The others just didn't get in. And we're walking up the ramp, and I'm still complaining. And I heard Two by Leonard. And I
over the public address.
Over the public address. Well, at that time, freshmen could not play on the varsity. So there was a freshman game going on, which nobody went to. You went for the varsity game. And I looked at Kathy, and I didn't know what I thought I was hearing. But then I heard it again, and I looked at Kathy and again, and I said, Kathy, it can't be. He cannot be playing basketball out there. And it was him, of course. And I had gone through all that dormitory. So I had to go back and tell everybody that he wasn't so bad after all. So that's my big story.
But you really didn't follow sports that much, did you? I mean, your dad was a sports fan, I know, but you really didn't know that much about basketball or how the scholarships worked and that whole college athletic process, did you?
No, I did not. In fact, you know, I hate to say how old we are, but back then there were no televisions, and you knew about a third of the schools in the state. So Bob being from Terre Haute, I didn't even know where Terre Haute was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew down to, I heard of Indianapolis and I heard of Shortridge, but anything beyond that, I just didn't know. So no, I had no idea. I mean, I knew they went to play, but I never thought about how they got there to do it.
Were you impressed that he was on the basketball team, or did that even make any difference to you?
It didn't really make any difference at the time. I just thought it was kind of funny. Once I found that out, I don't even remember going early to any of the freshman games. I still went to the varsity games.
You know, Slick is from Terre Haute. He didn't grow up, you know, like you did. I mean, he didn't come from even a middle-class family. He would admit, kind of rough around the edges. So what worked between you two? What clicked? Because is it opposites attracting, or is it something else?
I don't even know if I can answer that. It just seemed natural to be with him. He was very polite. He was fun. He never talked about playing basketball or whatever. He was just fun to be with.
He didn't act like he was a big deal?
No, not at all.
The Leonards take a roundabout path back to Indiana and wind up in charge of the Pacers when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with former Pacers assistant general manager, Nancy Leonard. She and Slick took off on quite an odyssey after graduating from IU. They were married the day after the ceremony, took a brief honeymoon to Chicago, and then waited 2 years while Slick completed his military obligation. He then began his NBA playing career with the Minneapolis Lakers. After 4 seasons there, the franchise moved to Los Angeles. So they loaded up the station wagon and headed across the desert. Imagine 2 parents, 3 kids, and a babysitter all piled into 1 car. And the air conditioning giving out near Phoenix, too. After a year in L.A., it was back to Chicago to play for the expansion Chicago Packers. And then he spent a season as player coach at the Chicago Zephyrs. After that, it was off to Baltimore to coach the Bullets in 1963, a team that had no chance of winning big. Let's pick up the story from there. Baltimore, you know, wasn't a very good team, and that tends to happen when the team isn't very good. The coach gets fired at some point.
Oh, yeah.
And you move back to Indiana to Kokomo, and Slick is working for Herff Jones, selling the class rings and so forth, and you're teaching, right, at Taylor High School?
Yeah. Taylor High School is a brand-new high school. It's on the south east corner of Kokomo, and I was fortunate enough to just happen to land in Kokomo when they were putting the high school together, and ended up having the business department.
Yeah. So, why did you pick Kokomo? Could you have lived anywhere you wanted
Bob was with Herff Jones, and I think most people will be familiar because their big manufacturing plant has always been in Indianapolis, but it's a high school supply company that does high school rings, announcements, caps and gowns, yearbooks, and anything involved with those kind of things in high school. He had a friend who just had played at IU with him that was a sales manager for Herff Jones for all over the United States. And he's the one that was responsible for getting Bob to come here and do that. He felt he would have a good rapport with high school principals and coaches because a lot of them had been in that field in some capacity. So we came here and we selected Kokomo because it was in the middle of the territory that he was going to travel. It was on 31. My home being South Bend, we could get to South Bend easy, and his in Terre Haute, we could still get down 31 and then on over to Terre Haute. So that was just a good central location for him to go either east, west, or whatever direction he had to go.
Yeah, and at that time, was it kind of sad to be leaving basketball, or were you happy to be done with it? Or
here again, it was just you just did it. It was mm-hmm. into your playing career, and you didn't find, and I think there were 8 teams at that time. So
I think so,
it wasn't the whole industry that it is now. Now, a lot of the fellas, when they're playing, their goal is to be involved in that sport, the professional sports at some college, but their goal, that's where they want to spend the rest of their life, doing something in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't like that then, back then when he started.
So you're perfectly content in Kokomo. He's working for Herff Jones. You're teaching. And then suddenly the ABA is formed and the Pacers have a franchise. And I know Bob was involved in that early tryout. The Pacers had that first year, but he wasn't going to coach the team. But the second year of the franchise, the team gets off to a bad start, and Larry Staverman is fired after they're 2-7. And then Slick gets the opportunity to coach. What did you think about that? Did you think, oh, this is crazy to get back into this? Or were you excited to be back in basketball like that? Or probably didn't think it would last.
I know it was his opinion that at that time, and not knowing how long this ABA was going to last. I mean, we really didn't know. He thought it was interesting and kind of had a yearning to do that. But he also felt that he could hold on to his Herff Jones territory, too. And it was really kind of funny when you think about it, because if you look at his first contract, and I don't even know if I could come up with it, it read that they would not interfere with his Herff Jones business. I can't believe this. And that they would allow him to have practices at night, which would mean that he could go to his schools in the daytime, take care of that business, and as a cushion, and then go ahead and have his practices at night. And, of course, nobody cared. It was just it was just a happy organization. You know, just it was not quite as intense as it is right now.
Right.
That worked out pretty good until it really became apparent that it was going to be impossible for him to be coaching in Denver and get in here from a game at 2:00 in the morning and drive back to Kokomo and then go do Herff Jones today and then come back to, and we had to get to Indianapolis. And at that point, then we had just had our first house, because we'd been in a position to made more sense to rent. Mm-hmm. Had our first house built in Kokomo, which was a big deal to us. And so we gambled, and we had to put the house on the market. And at that time, you know, you've taken out your first mortgage. You think you're going to be bankrupt anyway. You're never going to be able to make all these payments. But we did. We put it and came down here, found a builder. We're still in the same house. We've been here since 1970. Came here because with Bob being in the schools like he was, he had been in the Carmel schools, like the way that the whole school was administered, like the people felt it was a good school system for the kids, a lot of activities for the little kids, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, the Pacers, of course, win 3 championships. As, you know, anybody who was around the city then remembers those days awfully fondly. And the Pacers enter the NBA at a time when the franchise is struggling with ownership, and you know, the players who brought the championships have gotten older and moved on, and so you're not a strong team. And you wind up the assistant general manager of the Pacers when they entered the NBA in 1976 and held that position for 4 years. Can you tell the story of how that came about, how you became the, you know, basically the person who ran the front office of the Pacers?
I've tried to remember what I was doing at this meeting with Bob. There was a meeting in Indianapolis with the owners. It was right after they had agreed to the merger, that the ABA teams, most of them, were going to join the NBA.
Yeah, 4 teams went
and
in.
We were going to make that transition of going into the NBA. And we were at this meeting. They did not have, or were not going to use, the general manager they'd had before. I remember that discussion. There was discussion about ball players and everything. And then they said, well, what are we going to do for a general manager? Because Bob didn't felt, you know, he couldn't, he's not an administrative type of person. He's a basketball guy. Mm-hmm. So, and they were saying, oh, they were kind of apprehensive about this NBA, like it was some big glorified thing out there in the cloud, and this was this little ABA down here, and how were they going to run in the NBA? And something was said, and I piped up and said, Well, that's ridiculous. I said, this is just like the ABA. It's just that one says NBA and one says ABA.
Yeah, been in the ABA for 7 years.
You know, I had watched the NBA grow because it was much different when he left as it was to begin. And I said, you just run it like, you know, you're just going to have a few extra rules and regulations that are going to be different. And it's not going to be quite as lax and open as the ABA was. In other words, people are going to have passes to get in the dressing room, which they haven't had before. The media is going to be restricted to certain times. They can meet before and after. We're going to have X number of security people. And, you know, just it's going to be cut and dried things. And there was just silence in the room. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I never should have said anything. I mean, it was like, well, and one of them said, well, if it's so easy, why don't you do it? My mouth just fell complete. And Bob, at the time I could have got hold of him, I would have shook him. He said, well, she can do it. It's no problem at all. And that's how it actually started. Well, then the discussion was, because they were going to need me general manager.
Mm-hmm.
On what credentials? I mean, I had the business. I'm always not afraid of it at all. I knew.
Right. You had a business background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'd had, business departments. I'd dealt with kids and able to, and I knew I had pretty good management skills. Pretty laid back and get along with people I like. But anyway, they said, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? We got a woman general manager, and on top of that, she's the coach's wife. We could just see how this was going over. Now, you remember, we got Bob Collins out there and John Banch and all these newspaper people.
Uh-huh.
It ended up they agreed to give the title of general manager to Bob with the understanding that I was going to do all the administrative stuff. He was going to do the basketball stuff. So we always joked and said he had to do everything inside the lines of the court and I had to do everything out. But I would take the title of assistant general manager. They didn't feel there would be so much objection then. But I did feel that when I started, I thought I could just hear it, that I'm going to get questioned. And I will tell you a funny story. You know Bob Collins, who was a sports editor of the Star, and Bob was an extremely talented writer. He was so gifted, and a very gruff person. And you spoke very politely to Bob, and very nice. You know, and he was always nice to me, but still, you respected him. And the first telephone call I got was from Bob Collins, and he said, "I need to talk to you." And I thought, here it comes. You know, here it comes. He said, let's go. He said, I want to take you to lunch. And we'll go back here, Charlie and Barney's, which was a little place. I noticed they're just bringing that back, by the way, and Barney's.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll go back here. So we go back there for lunch, and we sit down, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, what is he going to say? And he said, I just want to tell you something. He said, I know you can do this. And if you have any trouble from anybody, you call me. That was the conversation.
So you're accepted right away.
One of the first things we had to do was we had to inform the media that they had to wear identifying badges and that they had hours they could get in and when they could go to practices. And that was the hardest thing for me.
Yeah.
That was very difficult for me to, because to begin with, everybody had been like family. We all just kind of came and went where we went. And if there was a party or something that kept everybody together, anyway, you didn't know if it was ushers or owners or who the people were. It was just everybody. You know, it was just fun time.
Nancy Leonard takes over the Pacers front office and saves the franchise when one-on-one continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with former Pacers executive Nancy Leonard. She ran the franchise's front office on a shoestring budget for its first 4 years in the NBA. But that shoestring nearly snapped in 1977 when the Pacers were running out of money. So she organized a telethon, pulling off a task that usually takes a year in about a week.
So did you have any trouble being accepted by local media or anybody else?
No, there wasn't one person that gave me trouble.
How about the other general managers and owners?
No, that was a funny thing when I think about it. As you very well know, I think it's pretty publicized that Bob and Brad Auerbach had their differences. And they were kind of like the Russians and the Americans getting ready to go to war all the time. But I did go to league meetings as you have responsibilities as general manager. And as I said, I didn't actually have that printed on my card, but that was my responsibilities. And every one of the general managers, I thought, oh boy, here, this is going to be some other experience. Dude, they were so great. And Red Auerbach treated me unbelievably nice.
Yeah.
Just very cordial. I mean, it was very pleasant and very, and I really enjoyed it. Of course, I like people. I like the game. I like anything about sports. So I was in seventh heaven.
How many people in the front office at this time?
We only had 13 people.
13 people.
I can't name all of them, but a lot of you are very close with Sandy Knapp, who went on to the Sports Corp and put that little operation together very solidly. And I was so concerned about how they acknowledged the girls in the organization, that they weren't just secretaries, that I named her vice president. And she, you know, there weren't even any real titles. It was just, anyway, she was great. You know how she is. Mm-hmm. She was just great. Lee Daniels was in charge of publicity, much like David Benner now. Lee, when he left, he went to Florida and ran some of their convention businesses down there. I had Basil DeVito, who ended up running the wrestling league. The talented people that we did have in that front office. And Doug Hausmeier, who is still in Indianapolis. Those were my heavies, as I call them. A couple of the girls, Roberta and Susie, that we still stay in contact with, but there were 13 of them.
It's amazing to think about this. You know, you're running a professional basketball front office, 13 people. The team is just trying to survive, you know, trying to keep stay in business. And you've got five kids at home. So what do you remember about that time? I mean, was it, how stressful was it? How were you able to do all this? I know you had help around the house with people, but, you know, still, how do you pull that off?
You know, sometimes I wonder. Well, to begin with, we had five children, but there's 13 years difference between Terry, the only girl that we have, and the youngest one, Timmy. Timmy was just old enough to start kindergarten, and the kids were pretty well spread out. And there were like, we had three of them a year apart, and then 3 years. So the three older ones, and then there were 8 years before we had Tommy and Timmy. Mm-hmm. So we got kind of like Mom and Dad here taking care of two little kids. So they were in school, and this, of course, the elementary school, Mohawk, is practically out our back door. And the high school was close. Middle schools are close. They helped out with the kids when they would get home from school, but I had a cleaning lady that was kind of like a glorified babysitter. Her name was Mary, and she would pick the kids up after school if they had to be picked up, and give them snacks after. I mean, she was just here. Mm-hmm. And I had her the whole time. I mean, she knew their routine as well as us.
Yeah.
The kids were really good, though. They really were.
I would think there would be days you'd be downtown, though, working, and you'd get a call, so-and-so got sick at school or something.
I never
family
did.
Emergency
the only,
or whatever.
And then the funny thing was, because there were no cell phones.
Right.
The only thing that I did that I still recall, and Tommy, our next to last son, still talks about it, I always left at 5 or 5:30 and to come home. And this one day, for some reason, I got into something, and I didn't even think about the time or something. And in the meantime, I was supposed to pick Tommy up at Mohawk Elementary, which is right here, around the corner from us. And he knew that he was to wait right there in front of the school until I got there. And it was 7:30. And he is sitting on the curb on the street.
For like 2 hours?
Oh, yeah. Waiting for me. He was not moving.
I bet he wasn't happy either.
I don't remember. He jokes about it now. He remembers. He remembers vividly. But he did not try to walk home or anything. He was right there waiting for me.
But what about on a night when there was a home game? You'd be in the office all day, but then there's a game at 7 or 7:30.
Okay, I would come home every night. And I don't know why I did this. I would come home every game night, come home. I would get all cleaned up again. You know, I'd take a bath, shower, get cleaned up again, and then go back down. Of course, our games weren't until 8.
Oh, 8
5
o'clock,
or 8, 10, one of the, whatever the time was.
Okay.
And that was the routine. But if it was weeknight and there were school nights, I had a babysitter. If it was weekend games or Sunday afternoon games, then I would take the kids. Mm-hmm. The kids would get to go to the ball games.
Okay.
And they did that even before I was doing that. That was just a given that they were not going to the games on school nights.
Well, probably your most dramatic moment running the Pacers was the telethon, 1977. Oh. The team is really on the ropes and in danger of, you know, being moved somewhere else or just collapsing. And you organized a telethon that did actually save the franchise. Can you take us through that process?
That's a nightmare. Do we have to talk about that? No, we were Bob and I were in, at the time, we're in Hawaii. We got to go to Hawaii, so you can imagine how exciting that was. Never been to Hawaii before. We're in Hawaii because there was a basketball tournament of some type over there where they would have the college seniors come in and the coaches from around the country, the professional coaches, and the scouts would be there watching them. It would be before the draft, and we get this telephone call, and it was Sandy or some, I don't remember who called, said, "You have to get back here right now." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because we are so close to being out of cash, and we've only got 3 weeks or something to sell X, it was 8,000 and something season tickets that we had to have in order to know we had the cash flow in order to pay the ball players. We had to do that or we'd lose them over the summer, and to have money to function through the rest of the season." And so we come home, and we're in a meeting. We always had I had set up, so Monday mornings we always had a round table meeting of everybody, and talked about what we were doing and made decisions as to what do you think we ought to do, or how should we do this, or anybody got any ideas. We were in there, and we knew we weren't going to reach it. We had sold the big bulk of season tickets, and closing up the last ones is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, you're not getting as large a commitment because good seats are gone by now. And I said, well, how can we get, we're going to have to get before all these fans that haven't got their tickets yet and make them understand that they've got to get their commitment in right now. We can't wait till September next year and then they'll all come rushing for their tickets. And so I said, well, I wonder if we could just do a telethon and get on television and tell everybody at one time. And everyone had jumped at that, and someone said, I think it was maybe Sandy, that she knew of or had heard a person in Zionsville that had worked on the Jerry Lewis telethon.
Mm-hmm.
And if we got him, I could talk to him, and he could help us. Maybe we could get it done. So they went over to, I think he came over to a meeting, and he said, you guys are crazy. He said, it takes 1 year to put on one of those Jerry Lewis telethons, and the minute that it's over with, we start working on it right then for the next year, and there's no way you can do it. And he left. I mean, okay, thank you. Charles, his name was Charles something. So I looked at him and I said, well, guess what, guys? We got 3 weeks. Fortunately, at that time, everything fell into place. WTTV was not like ABC, NBC, CBS.
Right, so independent.
Yeah, it was an independent station. And we talked to them, and they said they could figure out how to let us have 24 hours, because you start out and then you go all day and all that. And then I said, everybody, go talk to anybody you know that's in the entertainment business that can perform for a half an hour, could get up and just talk or be a comedian or juggle or do whatever you have to do. Just go. There's a lot of people and see, well, shoot, we had in 2 days we were loaded with the people agreeing to do that. So we had the telephone.
Yeah.
And
at the convention center.
Successful.
At the convention center.
It was very all night. We were taking those phone calls. And Mark, I'll tell you, just to understand the tenor of the city at that time, When we got down almost to the very end of the telethon, now we'd been going all day and all night and we're tired. These kids' carts started coming in with coffee cans. They had gone up and down the streets of Indianapolis collecting pennies and nickels and dimes.
Yes.
Because it meant so much to everyone. And that's when I cried.
Yeah.
And that's when I know every time they show something, they show me turning to Bob and crying and just saying, We did it. We sold 8,000, whatever it was. But it was those darn kids. You know, if those kids hadn't come in with those coffee cans and all that change in there.
Yeah, kids were literally bringing in piggy banks or money they had collected in the neighborhood. Yeah. You know, $7 here and $19 there or whatever. It was pretty amazing. And all three local stations, not only Channel 4, but the others carried parts of it. You know, so it was blanketed on television. Right. So everybody kind of just pitched in and did whatever they could do to help. And the mayor was out there. Mayor Hudnut was out there. And, yeah, it was an amazing thing. I've seen clips at the very end of it.
You know, the amazing thing about it, too, you use the word amazing, is that it was very entertaining. I mean, the people that
like
offered
to... a local talent
to,
show.
Oh, my gosh. It really was. It was like Indianapolis's local talent. If you have any talent at all, we need it. We will give you all the exposure you want.
It was a chance for them to get exposure, and they didn't get paid, but they got exposure.
Yeah.
So, but to put this together like in a week or whatever that you did is pretty remarkable. But again, I guess the convention center, did they donate space for you?
Yeah, we did not pay for that space.
Yeah.
We did not.
Convention center to
nobody charges for anything. In fact, they were even bringing in somebody. This is so sad that I can't remember, so I can give them credit. But they were bringing in sandwiches and stuff to drink for us. And
yeah, I want to say Arby's, but I'm not 100% sure. But
I don't remember.
Know. Yeah, people. So everybody donated everything, and you got the goal, and the franchise was saved. You know, the only sports franchise ever saved by a telethon, and it was put together in about a week.
So. It was so much fun.
The end of an era arrives for Slick and Nancy Leonard, and a new one begins when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Slick's wife, Nancy Leonard. She ran the Pacers front office for four seasons, but when the team's absentee owners decided to make a coaching change, it was time for her to go as well. But only for a while. Then, though, after, let's see, in 1980, you'd done this for 4 years. There's been ownership changes. You have an absentee owner in Sam Nasty in California. And so they want to make a coaching change. And so suddenly in 1980, you and Slick are, you know, I mean, you're fired. Was that a difficult time, or were you ready to be done with it by then?
That's difficult for anybody, especially when you consider Operation Family almost. I mean, we'd all worked so hard, and we were inch by inch getting ahead. It took a lot of hard work for everybody, and you could see the television coming around. You knew, you just had a vision of what was going to happen out there, and I think that was one reason that let us be as successful, because we saw that vision. You know, you saw the improvements in the television contracts and the just everything that was going on, and that made the league a lot more solid. But the sad part was to not have the financial background that you need, or the access that you need. It was
you weren't able to be competitive.
No, because we'd get really great players in here through drafting or whatever, and then they would have a right to an increase, or they'd want a 4 or 5 year contract for some protection for themselves, and somebody else would offer them way over what we could offer them. I mean, we lost Dan. I'll never forget. We lost Danny Brownfield to Atlanta. And Danny just turned out to be, he was always a super person anyway. He's the kind of guy you want on your team. And he turned out to be an all-star out in Atlanta and just had a very successful career. We lost him for a $25,000 bonus.
Oh,
we didn't have it. We couldn't put our hands on $25,000. Now look at today.
Yeah.
That's, lost a lot of players because we just couldn't compete.
So, I mean, you and Bob, your lives were just immersed in basketball all those years, and then suddenly you're out of it. Was it a difficult adjustment to make? Was there kind of a culture shock?
No, at first, one thing that really helped, honestly, I will say that the group that came in to take over the Pacers, the group from California, they had just written a 5-year contract for Bob. They had given him a 5-year contract. So he was protected. So that was, because there was, you know, some financial support there, that was another huge, because do we have to think about moving somewhere, you know, to go on? You have to have a way to make a living. So we had that, but particularly, it was very difficult for Bob to not be able to compete and know it because it was the lack of players. He was very tired. He was very exhausted. And I think that having some space time there was probably the best thing that could ever happen to him.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't look at it that way. No, that was not the way he looked at it, but I still think that that was a blessing.
And then, after a few years, he gets the opportunity to come back as a broadcaster, and lo and behold, you're back in the game, so to speak. You know, you're both going back to the games, and you're kind of back in the show.
Yeah, it's like no time. There was like no collapse of time in there.
Yeah.
It was just
a couple, 3 years, I guess, before he was back in the picture, so. Yeah. And there's less, I guess, at that point, you can enjoy the games more. There's not the pressure.
No.
No,
I will say that there's as much pressure for every one of these games as there was when he was playing.
Yeah, you still feel it?
Oh, dear, yes.
I've got a theme question I've asked everybody for this show. That's when, I don't know if it'll apply to you or not, but when you're sleeping at night, particularly when you were working for the Pacers, did you have dreams related to your job? Did you have dreams about basketball or about games or anything like that?
No.
Never? Okay.
I did not. So. I will tell you that if I dreamt anything, I would dream, I wish I could get some more sleep.
I could imagine.
Sleep was at a minimum.
Oh, yeah.
I just remember, the reason I said that is because when Bob started coaching, especially I remember this, we still had Herf Jones, and we have an office at home, and we had two secretaries that I had gotten from the high school. I took, you know, they have those classes in high school, I think they call it DECA, where they want to place the kids to work in a business and learn. And both of the girls that we had, Mary Williams and Lynn Risley, came out of that program. Then they stayed because we had Herf Jones on the language at camp. Then we had the rest and we're coaching. You know, we're really busy, and they did all the paperwork. But I remember it was always late at night. Our games didn't start till 8, and then we go eat afterwards. We get home, it'd be 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I had to get up with the kids in the morning and get them to school. I remember every morning I would come in on the sofa in the family room, and for 30 minutes after they went to school, before the girls got here, I'd take a snooze. And then I'd run upstairs and get cleaned up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you had to manage your time very carefully, I'm sure. You had organizational skills in that way. And your management skills, people I've talked with who worked there, you know, thought you were a great manager because you were very direct, no time wasted, you know, that it was just very businesslike, you know, for lack of a better term. Did you have a particular management style, or was there anywhere that you learned how to manage?
I never thought about a management style. I don't think that probably didn't come into play until maybe the last 15 or 20 years. My thinking was, we all had to do our jobs at the best of our ability, and I didn't know what the heck some of them really did. So what I actually did was I told them I'd like to have a meeting once a week on Monday, and then I sat down with each one of them, and I said, I don't know what you do. I don't know what your responsibilities are, but I want you to tell me what you do, and I would like for you to write it down. So we had an idea that, and I didn't really realize what I was putting together at the time. Now, this is just standard. And I said, and then afterwards, I said, and I'm not going to show this, this is between you and I, but I would like to know if there were a change of responsibilities, what one thing would you like to do to find out, is somebody else, are they satisfied with what they're doing, or what's their feeling? I got through that okay. And I did learn, and I said, I want you to know I'm not capable of doing your jobs, but I depend on you, because how you do your jobs is going to be how I'm going to look at when this is all over with. I'm either going to be a horrible person in here, or they're going to go, wow, that thing's really working over there. So I'm totally depending on you doing what you say. These responsibilities are yours. I did not micromanage, but I think I had, in that style, I had high demands. I mean, I don't know how to explain that. Mm-hmm. I expected...
You had high expectations for people and demanding.
No micromanaging, and that when we had our meetings, we really did sit down and discuss. Nobody came in and said, we're going to do this, 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 and this, and this. We said, here's what we have to do. What are anybody's ideas? What have you seen work? What doesn't work? And then I'd have to make the final decision.
One-on-One with Nancy Leonard continues in a moment. All right, welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Hey, thanks to Nancy Leonard for sharing her story. I thought it was appropriate for Mother's Day, since not every professional sports executive raises five kids while on the job. But it could have run anytime. Her career is worthy of a One-on-One episode on its own. And in fact, I didn't even touch on much of what she's really accomplished. She's been a successful realtor, too, one who helped buy and sell homes for several Pacers players and coaches. And she's served on several boards for churches and charity organizations as well. She seems to have the knack for getting things done in a quick and efficient way, with no BS, no ego, and no insecurities. It's no exaggeration to say that if not for her efforts in those early years of the NBA, the Pacers franchise might not be here today. Now, if you missed part of this episode or want to hear one of the others in the One-on-One library, no problem. Go to 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, click on the podcast link, and all the shows are there waiting for you. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I do the social media thing on Facebook and Twitter, too. That Twitter handle is none other than @MarkMonteith. And I'll be back again next week with a special Indy 500 edition of One-on-One when I talk with the old and new radio voice of the 500, Paul Page, right here on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.